I'd first like to begin by acknowledging that we're on Darug country and we acknowledge the traditional owners. We acknowledge Darug elders, past, present, and obviously going into the future. This is their land, it's unceded sovereign land. I just wanted to say a little bit about the whole project that we're doing that Alexis is involved in, as well as some of us in the Writing and Society Centre. So the Caribbean Conference, in a sense, is being built into a larger project. And so you are sort of, I guess, unwitting laboratory intellectuals conducting experiments with ideas that we have pre-implanted into your mind. But the project is called Other Worlds. And there's a reason why it's called Other Worlds. It arises from a frustration felt by many people with, in the literary studies domain, the term world literature. The sense that the methodologies that have been developed in the sphere called world literature largely arise from data analysis and from the social sciences, or conversely, from people responding polemically to the provocations that arise from a kind of meta-structural analysis of the world. So our premise was pretty simple, that we were going to, as a group, look at the totality of literature from the perspective of living, active writers. Writers, it so happens, who are in Australia and who are invested in probably more particular and idiosyncratic relationships within the literary world here in Australia and interacting with other literary worlds elsewhere. So Alexis Wright is one of our investigators. Gail Jones, are you here, Gail? Gail Jones. Who's in the Writing and Society Research Centre. Gail is another one of our creative investigators. Nicholas Joes, who sends his apologies, he was going to be here. He's at the University of Adelaide. He's a writer and anthologizer and critic. And J.M. Kitsaya, who's also at the University of Adelaide and who also sends his apologies. He wasn't able to attend this event. And there's also me and Anthony Ullman, the director of the Writing and Study Centre and the chief investigator of this, and Sam Trahan, a PhD student who's come onto the project. So my own involvement in this has led me to this term meridian. So I said a few words about this right at the start of the conference. So the term really famous from Pascal Casanova's study, where she says, you know, all world literature is structured by a Greenwich meridian, which is London, Paris, and New York. And that's the sort of Greenwich Mean Time of the global literary field. Well, if we're talking about literary meridians, we're thinking more about alignments between literary worlds, that is, the worlds that literature itself creates, not, as it were, social relationships and relationships between publishers and translators and so forth in the world itself. So we're looking at the relations between literary habitats that may not be directly connected, but which nevertheless seem aligned in spirit and purpose. And when I came up with the idea of combining the Caribbean Conference with this Other World project, I invited Alexis to come here and share some of her thoughts. She's not a Caribbean specialist, she's just here to talk about some of her writing and the way in which it interacts with Caribbean worlds, because she had spoken so enthusiastically about Patrick Chamwisso in particular, but other Caribbean writers like Marlon James. I wrote something about Marlon James. She read it and said, ah, that's a great book, you know, the Brief History of Seven Killings, and I see you've got his latest book there. So that just piqued my interest. What about the Caribbean and Caribbean literary world resonated for Alexis? And so this conversation is all about sort of launching from there to think about making literary worlds in general and how literary worlds relate to each other. Now, Australians will all know Alexis and her writing and her work, I'm pretty sure, but I do want to introduce her formally to an international guest from the Caribbean and from the North Atlantic. So Alexis is a member of the Wanyi Nation of the Gulf of Carpentaria. She is the author of the novels The Swan Book, which won the ASAL Gold Medal, and Carpentaria, which won many national literary awards, including the Premier Prize, the Miles Franklin Award in 2007. Her work is published all over the world, gets translated all over the world, including, importantly, in China, where she's had a lot of really interesting interactions through the translations of her work into Chinese. But she's also an author of non-fiction titles, and this is extremely important to the body of work that she's produced. Grog War, which is a study of alcohol abuse in Tennant Creek, which kind of have to use fiction at one point for a number of reasons that I won't go into. So it's actually, I guess, a fiction, non-fiction work. And then there's Take Power, which is a collection of essays and stories celebrating 20 years of land rights in Central Australia. Most recently, she published the extraordinary, or put together, the extraordinary collective memoir of Tracker Tilmas, who's Aboriginal visionary leader in the Northern Territory, an economist and a philosopher. And she created this book by interviewing a whole range of people that Tracker knew that could tell Tracker's story as well as Tracker. So you get this interweaving of many, many Trackers into the one text.
Thank you, Ben. And I'd like to acknowledge the country of the Jurong people and elders past and present, and whose country we're on today.
So a very straightforward beginning. Tell us about the moment that you first learnt of Patrick Chamoiseau's fiction and how it is that you came to read his work and get involved in the literary world of Martinique and the Caribbean.
It was back in 1998. And it's funny you just mentioned the Kalkaringi Convention was 1998, and I read a review of Texaco, which was in the Australian newspaper, The Age. I thought it was I can't remember properly now, but I think there might have been one in the Australian. But I have a habit of keeping reviews of books, and then I order books. I was living in Central Australia at the time, and I always just love ordering books and having books sent up there to me, because we didn't have much of a bookshop in town, and it was just nice getting packages in the mail, and this is the review. And we had the big newspapers. So it was two books I ordered from this. This was one of my other favourite writers of all time, as well as Carlos Fuentes. So this was Carlos Fuentes' book, A New Time for Mexico, and which has fantastic essays in there, and one that I learned a lot Fuentes said that no time in Mexico has ever been resolved, and which really resonate with me in the Aboriginal world. All times are important, no time has ever been resolved, and learned a lot from Chamoiseau over the years, Fuentes, I mean, and of course Chamoiseau. I'm saying his name wrong, and I really apologise to people here from the Caribbean. I say Chamoiseau, but it's Chamoiseau, this is I come from Northern Australia, and we have ways of pronouncing lots of things, and I don't think many people in Northern Australia would even know how to pronounce his name at all. But I do make an effort, and I say Chamoiseau, but it is Chamoiseau, and I'll do my best. the review at the bottom was Texaco, and I read it, and I ordered both books. But I'm pretty sure at the time there was another review, and that was in the Australian, because it had the cover of Texaco in the newspaper. And that was, I don't know if you have the same cover over in all parts of the world, but the English-speaking cover had the hands of an old man holding a spade. And that just really, again, resonated with me. And I thought, I've got to read this book. And really, I it came in the mail, and I just learned so much from Patrick Chemisset and in his writing. I was at the time, I was in the middle of writing Carpentaria, my own book, and I just looked at Texaco and I thought, God, and and this is just—it's just an incredible work. And how did you do something like this? And I was just blown away. And it just there were so many things in there that just was helpful to me. And because I'm always looking for, you know, new ways of thinking, new ways of writing, new ways of imagining, and. And I had a look at it, and I didn't bring Texaco up with me. I brought a few of his other books, but and I knew I was going to have to get Marlon James's new book at the airport in Melbourne on the way, because my bookshop didn't have it in at the time. And so I did get it, so I'm really looking forward to Marlon James's new book. But the way Chemisset spoke, the warrior of the imaginary, and truly he is, and he talked about telling the story, you know, with all this narrator in Texaco, and we need to tell the story stitch by stitch, storytelling, and that, you know, this is the Aboriginal world as well. We have to tell the story, and you know, the whole story, stitch by stitch, of our insalubrious existence, that to me, you know, and that wanting to the council, you know, wanted to get rid of the insalubrious dwellings, you know, on the side of the hill, and that has happened so much in our world of bulldozing, you know, our camps on the edge of town. And I said, you know, there was just so much that spoke to me in his work, and I could go on and about language as well. And
yeah, I was going to ask you about language. I remember the Indian poet Arvind Mehrotra. He came to a conference similarly pitched against world literature that I organised a few years ago, and he made all these really fascinating comments about world literature that were kind of shooting from the hip, I guess, I saw it as. And I said, oh, Arvind, that's quite an unbuttoned kind of way that you engage with this whole world literature idea. And he was like, there are no buttons. No buttons. There's just no buttons involved. I should say that Arvind's also published by IBA in Australia. But when I was reading Chemisset's Texaco for the first time at your kind of incitement, and reading Carpentaria, and I didn't read one and then the other, I was reading sort of chapter by chapter, sort of flicking between the two, seeing what resonated. And that came into my head, that Chemisset's got no buttons. In his style, there's something just, you know, he's flamboyant. And I remember the first time I read Carpentaria and being struck all over again by the voice. It does what it does. It's peculiar kind of vernacular, which is obviously Aboriginal English and the Aboriginal worldview, but infused with lots of things, no doubt, including Chemisset. It just seems, I wondered, I guess, if there was a catalyst there. Seeing a kind of writer with no buttons allowed, help you to just kind of have that expansive, devil-may-care kind of narrative voice of Carpentaria.
I guess it did help, and a number of writers did help, because I read writers from all over the world, and I often tell the story about Marquis, you know, his 100 Years of Solitude, and how he would write it in the way that his aunts, you know, his old aunties talked, and that, and I remembered that once when I was going across the footbridge, you know, I was going home in town in Alice Springs, and there were two old countrymen in front of me, and they were talking about finishing up and in a really, you know, repressed sort of way. And I felt like I should tell them, no, don't talk like that, don't think like that. And then I thought, no, I shouldn't even be listening to what they're talking about. And, could be really important lawmen, you know, then I shouldn't be overhearing what they're talking about. And but it then struck me, and it maybe a message, you know, that I should write Carpentier in the voice of the old people and how they talk and spoke. And that was turning the whole thing around, and the whole manuscript from, you know, starting again and going through it. And having the right voice, because it always struck me it wasn't right. Mm. What I was doing wasn't right, and I wanted that book to be authentic in as many ways as I possibly could. Authentic to country, authentic to people, authentic to our times, but it's people like Chamisso who give you strength to do that sort of thing. And I knew, but I had been looking, and I look across the world to writers everywhere to find out. And at that time, I was just, you know, I'd had one novel written, you know, published, and that was more of a mainstream type of treatment. And then the two other books were non-fiction. But I knew Carpentier had to be so much different, so much more, and the challenge had to be greater than what I did there. In a format which is more like a format to get published, you know that they teach you or say, well, you've got to write this way if you're going to get published in this country, and that seemed fake to me and not right. And with Carpentier, and because it was a novel very much about our country, our traditional country, I wanted it to be as good as it possibly could in every single way, and push myself to do it. But going back to Chamisso's work, then, you know, the next one that came along was Solobo Magnificent, and that was just another book. I was just really, I was just amazed by it. He really is a master. And have you read this?
I haven't got to that one.
No. And you're an expert in the Caribbean. You should be reading these things. You know, I just come from, you know, Northern Australia. this is a book, again, you know, I wish I'd written this book. And when I first read it and started reading it, I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, I wish I could have done this, and I should have done a book like this. And this tells the tale of, you know, the storyteller who died it's not the banyan tree, what is it? And he dies in mid sentence, telling a story, and the book starts with the incident report of the police, which is written in a formal sort of way, but in a formal way of pleasing, you know, the French language, and, you know, from people who don't really, you know, it's not their language in a way, but in that formal expectation. And this happens to a lot to Aboriginal people in this country, that we're expected to write in the correct way. Particularly, you know, if you want to get jobs, you know, if you want to work in the public service and other places, that you toe the line and I've seen people struggle with this. You know, struggle to, you know, write in the correct way. And then that's the incident report. And then the rest of the book is the story of what really happened and told by all these different people and what happened. And they were brutalized and all sorts of things. They were accused of murder and all sorts of things. And it was just awful, just awful. But, you know, he also, you know, writes in a way people talk and, you know, and it's kind of funny, but it's terrible. And this happens. This was happening right outside my door in Central Australia. It happens all the time, of people being brutalised by police and people in the, you know, camping in the riverbed and or all over the place. It's just routine, and of being really treated badly. And it just made me feel really ashamed that I hadn't written a book like this. And so that's Solid by Magnificent. Oh, you know, a classic, and everyone should read it. So.
clear the 10 things.
Yeah, I'm going to be the member of the, you know, the Caribbean Study Association.
I'm not going to face you again before I've read that.
And then there's Migrant Brothers, you know, that just came out last year, and where he's really talking about, and you know, a new way of thinking. The world needs new ways of thinking about, you know, what's happening in the world with people, you know, looking for new places to live. And he follows the Edward Gazant, you know, idea of politics poetics of relation, and everything is related. And that's very much an Aboriginal way of thinking as well, where everything is related, everything is connected. We're in kinship with country, with the, you know, the sea and the skies, and with people, with the animals and plants, and it's a very cosmopolitan outlook as well. And I can, you know, understand that. I don't understand everything of Edward Gazant, but I try. And Chamisso, you know, makes it much easier to understand. And then the slave old man.
This would be a question you could answer with the experience of reading Slave Old Man or all of the books by Chamisso that have influenced you. I mean, I think what you've just been describing is absolutely daily reality across the Caribbean. The policing of language, as it's called, the continuum from the more deep Creole that has the sort of more deeply, depends which island, but islands I'm thinking of like Jamaica, more deeply African syntax and quite a few African words, and then a continuum to the standard English or standard Jamaican English, if we're talking about Jamaica or whichever island it might be.
Yeah.
And the politics and the way power gets distributed in relation to language is something that has been a conversation in the Caribbean since the period of the transatlantic slave trade. And the term, I think, that has been so pivotal, it's definitely pivotal for Glissant, definitely pivotal for Chamisso, it's been pivotal in a different way in the English-speaking islands, has been Creolization. Mm-hmm. And the whole change of perspective that happened towards emancipation, of rethinking what this language is, not as some kind of improper language, or whatever it gets called, broken English, and thinking of it as a creative ferment. But there's a paradox involved, and it's a paradox, I think, which is part of what you were just saying, is that it's being created from a history of pain and a history of suffering. So does that idea resonate?
A history of control. And it's very much, you know, here as well. And I wrote that essay last year, you know, what happens when, you know, someone else tells your story. And and that's what it was very conscious about with Carpenteria as well. You know, it has a few lines at the start of the book where, you know, everyone, you know, they think, you know, We know your story already. We don't want to hear you tell the your story because we already know your story. And people think they know your story by other people telling the story for you. And that's why, you know, the other reason why Carpentaria had to be so much more, because I want to say, do you really know this story? You don't know it. And those old men talking, you know, that I was listening to, their voices are never heard. You know, and people don't want, you know, they talk and they can't talk, you know, the straight standard English, and because they speak Walpri or they speak Pitjantjatjara or they speak, you know, many different Aboriginal languages, you know, and English may be the seventh language, and so nobody they don't want to make the effort to understand, you know, what someone's talking about, and they think and everyone else is telling the story for Aboriginal people, and it's happening to this very day, and you know to what's happening on communities or what's written in the newspaper. It's what the media say or what the government say or what some commentator says about Aboriginal people, but not those people themselves.
Do you mind talking a bit about our experiences going to chat to your friend Clarence Walden? Because I think that might be relevant.
Well, that again, Clarence is a Gungalita man from Gulf of Carpentaria, who grew up on a mission in called Dumaji, and as a child he was put in dormitories for boys and dormitory for girls, and their parents only had access to them maybe on the weekend, because the parents were sent away to work on some cattle station somewhere, and so the mission had the, you know, control of the children. It's the same like Tracker, Tracker. They were sent away from their families 1,000 kilometres away, so their family would have no access to them whatsoever, and have no influence on their own children growing up, and this is all a part of a push for assimilation and destroying Aboriginal culture. So with Clarence, he wanted me to write his book. Everyone's sort of lining up. They wanted me to write a Tracker for them, and Tracker is a huge book. It's a big fat book, and it took a long time to write, and so I'm looking for volunteers to help write these huge books, and Clarence is a really strong man. He's a leader of his people. He's a traditional man. He's a cultural man, and he thinks in a cultural way, and he believes in a cultural way. We had a big campaign to stop a huge multinational mining company from building a mine, Century Mine, up in the Gulf of Carpentaria. And there was all sorts of protests, and we tried every which way to try and stop that mine, and holding up rivers, not letting, you know, the miners through. And Clarence did things like lock the gates of the airport at Dumaji so politicians couldn't land and go and talk, you know, silly business to people, you know, in Dumaji when he was the mayor, and he wouldn't let them in. And he's a very strong man and very strong beliefs, and he said, you know, I remember hearing him talk at one of the big meetings that we had down in Lorne Hills, and he said to everybody, he said, I can stop the miners easy, I'll just throw broken glass bottles on the road. That will stop them. And everyone believed him. I believed him. And I just believe he said it. And he's, you know, it's true. I believe you. And it's not,
I think I believe him now when you first told me that story.
Yeah. It's not just broken glass bottles, but it's a different thing. It's a mental thing, and what he believes, and because the mining trucks, the big mining haul trucks that were eventually brought in, they're huge. You know, they're like big, huge. You know, two or three story buildings. They were the huge tires, and there's no way you could stop them with a broken glass bottle. But he just put belief into people. People who came through all that oppression and institutionalization in a mission that was really tightly controlled, where they weren't allowed to smoke, they weren't allowed to drink beer, alcohol. They weren't allowed to even have people like Slim Dusty, I don't know, people from overseas here. But Slim Dusty was an icon, it's kind of an icon in Australia, country and western singer. And everybody knew Slim Dusty, and everyone and liked his music if you were to come from Northern Australia. And Rich Chemsey books. But they wouldn't let Slim Dusty come to Dumitru because he would pollute the minds of their people, their inmates, the Aboriginal people there. And
Clarence is an incredibly important political leader.
Yes.
And a very magnetic presence and compelling in so many ways. So a few months ago, Alexis led a group of us to Dumitru, and Alexis did a series of conversations with Clarence, and I had a hand in editing the material, though I had sort of Clarence in headphones for several weeks there, a couple of months, daily at times. And, you know, it, in some ways it feels like a facetious question to ask, but nevertheless, you know, we got money from the Australian Research Council to do world literature, and you said, let's go talk to Clarence Walden. So I almost want to ask, is Clarence Walden world literature? And is his voice what you think of when you think about creating a world? What you are doing in your own writing in a different way.
Yeah. With Clarence, I'll just go back to that again, and the work that we did up there and the recording, you know, of Clarence talking about country, talking about culture, talking about the dreaming that, you know, that his, you know, his areas that he's, you know, responsible for and has huge responsibilities for different dreamings, you know, Devil Dreaming, Rainbow Serpent, Barramundi, and he talked about all those things. Really, really important. We're very privileged to hear that. And he talked about those times of what happened to him in the mission and his family and how he was treated and all those things. And after he finished talking, and you were there too, and he kept saying how grateful he was, how pleased he was that at last he was able to tell his story. He didn't want other people to tell his story for him. You get versions of his story through, you know, official channels or as statistics, you know, in closing the gap policy or whatever. Clarence is not a statistic. Clarence is a person. And a very important person, and even if he wasn't, he's a person, and he's somebody, and he needs to. To me, that's what world literature is about: is people being able to tell their stories, no matter who they are, and in the form that they want to tell their stories. And that's if you got a notion of world literature, it has to have a purpose. And for me, the purpose is, you know, is the planet and humanity, and where, you know, that is our responsibility, and the environment and everything goes with it. It would be the Aboriginal way, the connected way. Everybody's connected.
One of the moments that was most eye-opening when we were having those conversations was right on the first day we settled down on the Nicholson River, which runs by Dumiji, the site of the mission, to have a chat. And Alexis and her husband Tolly were just catching up with Clarence, talking about politics and the new mine that was slated to, well, an expansion of the mine that Alexis mentioned before, the Century Zinc mine. And Clarence started, in the flow of conversation, talking about the movement of stories up and down country from different areas, and how this shapes all kinds of things, shapes social reality, shapes myth, and shapes, in a quite more literal sense, legal title to different areas. So this is, you know, it's historic, but it's also very current. And there was a moment when he was talking about how a story got stuck in the Sandover River, and that's why there's a tree there. And Tolly, who's, you know, he knows, he talked to different communities, know people all over the country. He stopped Clarence and said, "Clarence, are you talking about people who are alive, or are you talking about the dreaming?" And Clarence was like, "Oh, I'm talking about the dreaming." But Tolly hadn't realised. Like, he's like, okay, that makes total sense. So that takes me back to the comment about Carlos Fuentes about wanting to write old times. That seemed to me precisely what was going on. Like, for Clarence, it wasn't some before then and then this is here now. He was.
It's all one. It's.
So if I make that a kind of prompt to kind of back out of the world of, you know, Northern Australia, Indigenous Australia, to some of the writers that you've looked to in other parts of the world, would you say that you're looking for writers, or you've found inspiration from writers who do the same thing, or do something that you can learn from to kind of build a way of being strong in yourself when you're writing or you're creating worlds that have this temporality of old times at once?
Well, I'm looking for writers who, for all those things. But I thought about it in the last couple of days too, is what I've been doing is giving myself a broader education and imagination. And teaching myself, you know, how to imagine. I think that's, you know, sort of missing in a lot of, you know, in the world a lot, with a lot of people, because they don't get a chance to sit down and say, how can we imagine this, or how can we imagine that? And you just, people get on and do their job and they don't have time to even be even fanciful think of things in a different way, see things and be able to imagine it different. And so that's what I think I've been looking for, is and searching for and trying to improve how I imagine, and because that's my job, to imagine.
Alexis has been pulled from the realm of imagination to give quite a lot of lectures. I mean, that's imagination of a different kind lately, and she sent me these lectures ahead of this chat. And just to give a sense of the range of writers that she'd been reading and thinking about, Seamus Heaney in Ireland, Carlos Fuentes in Mexico, Amos Oz in Israel, Timothy Moe from Hong Kong, now based in the UK, Laszlo Krasznahorkai from Hungary. But the one I want to settle on is Ah Lai, a Tibetan Chinese writer, And you said something about Arlai which really struck me, which I wanted to read out. The Chinese-Tibetan writer Arlai, in describing his work, said he started by constituting his own world instead of rushing off to embrace other worlds, as such urgency could lead writers to warp their own rich, self-styled and gradually built-up world. So it just struck me the kind of paradox involved in this when, you know, you're talking about a world that has been devastated by the colonial process and that does need to be carefully, stitch by stitch, reconstructed through acts of imagination, but also getting that broader education in how other people might construct their world. Is there a tension there, a pulling away from your, I guess, your own, you know, world of Wanyi country and Gulf of Carpentaria, or does it all, in a sense, do you think, come back to? I don't quite know how to formulate this question, but the paradox struck me that how much time do you spend abroad before you're sort of foreign to your own imaginative world or something like that?
Yeah, I don't travel abroad all that much, and but I travel in other ways, in, you know, through the imagination and by reading broadly, you know, people who are really imaginative in their own worlds. Arlai, what he's talking about, you know, the construction of his own world, it's a huge construction, you know, which, you know, whether you're doing it in Tibet or you're doing it in, you know, the Gulf of Carpentaria, or you're doing it, you know, in Martinique or where, it's a huge construction that a writer, you know, is taking on in their work. There's lots of questions, there's lots of ways of imagining things. And so, you know, Arlai, he does look broadly. He does look all around the world, just like I do, just like, you know, anybody else. You know, if they, you know, really serious about, you know, the project, you know, or, you know, what their work is. And I've learnt that, you know, from my own background. Before I was a writer, and in the work that we were doing, and in trying to construct our world from what it's become here. And so we were taught by our elders to look broadly, and you know, to get the best knowledge. And so it's only natural that I would do that, and continue to do that as a writer. But you know, Arlai as well, you know he looks broadly, but he goes back and he works in his own world. And I was in Shanghai early last year, and we did a session together, and the translation, we had instant translation, you know, by these, you know, amazing students, just talking in our ear and instantly translating what each other was saying, so we could have proper dialogue with each other. And and he was talking about, you know, the different sort of language issues and everything, and, you know, in Tibet, and you know, and different kind of issues and problems and so forth. And so he's trying to grapple with that, you know, that, and constructing worlds there. And and it's the same here, you know, there's a lot of things happening, and you try to keep up with it all. But at the same time, you're also, you know, trying to learn, you know, learn throughout the world as well, and bring it back. And and a lot of it sort of gets left at the door, you know, while you try then to do your work.
As part of this project, Arlai wrote an essay response to Carpentaria, and we're getting that translated. And it is such an interesting reading of the book, the things he picks up on, and he has the most striking description of normal phantom and the way normal phantom is in that work. But I'm not going to ask more questions and further take the great privilege it has been of being chair. You know, I'd like to go to the floor and see if there are any questions that people want to ask Alexis, whether about her writing, about Caribbean writing and the impact that Caribbean writing may have had or anything else for that matter. Liz?
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to ask about the Carpentaria songbook, a long book, and they must have taken a long time to write. My question is about how do you find sitting with that act of building a world for a long time? I mean, is that a hard thing to do, to live with the creation of a world for years before it is finished?
It is, particularly if you're doing other work and you it's very hard to concentrate on you know the work that you're trying to do in a book. Some writers it's easier. With me, it takes time, and I'll take the time. I've learned to be patient. It's another thing I've learned from people over the years who've guided me. Is patience, particularly when I was a really hot-headed young woman, I've got the patience to be there and for as long as it takes. But it's good to live in that world, you know. I really enjoyed living in the world of Carpentaria because the characters were huge. The characters that I was building in that world, I really liked those characters. I wish, you know, we had more of those type of people in real life. When I finished that book, it took 6 years to write that book and 2 years to even understand how I could even write it. But the day that I finished, it should have been the happiest day of my life because I spent so much time on it. But I felt I felt very, very sad. I was heartbroken, really, because that was the world that I enjoyed living in. I live in the world of the writing.
This is really more, it's a comment and it's a question at the same time, maybe. Referencing back to the world of the imagination, the writer's world, I think. And having just finished historical fiction, I guess I found it really fascinating that how the factual and the fictional actually merge together. And sitting in those worlds, I discovered, because it's set in Jamaica where I was born and also in Australia, colonial Australia. And I did a lot of research in colonial Australia, obviously because I'm here, and it was a lot harder to get research done in Jamaica. But then when I found I was writing, the world of the imagination took over Jamaica. And I found myself in places that I didn't think or know I would end up in, because it's talking about slave and plantation work. And then when I came to write the colonial side, even though I'd been a guide and worked at Kaipa Barracks and knew, you know, the facts coming out of my brain, the world of the imagination didn't come to life in the same way. And I'm wondering how much of this imagination and this world, this created world, is really about spirit and really about us diving into the collective unconscious, essentially. And what I discovered is that even though I didn't have all the facts about the plantation, when someone that did read it that did have all the facts actually said, that's really factual. It's really more of a comment and just talking about this world of imagination. And I loved what you said about that's our work. You know, that's, we have to develop skills to talk about that. And some of it's, I think, factual skills, the act of writing. And some of it, I think, is actually spirit skills, you know, to access those other worlds, really. So I'm not sure it's a comment, it's a question. What do you think about that? Is that how you write?
No, I like what you say. I don't know where it comes from in the end. I think, you know, it helps to go looking for it and looking for ways other people imagine and to help yourself. But I think in the working, as a writer, it comes from the subconscious, or it comes from the spirits, hanging over your shoulder and saying, giving you a slap on the wrist and saying, no, it's not that way, it's this way, don't you know? I didn't know how to explain it. It's just something that happens, and it's with you, and you go with it, and you just build on it, in the work that you're doing.
Perhaps I should start by saying that nearly all of the Australians I've met who are interested in the Caribbean come to the Caribbean through the literature of the English-speaking Caribbean. I've never met anyone who came to the Caribbean through the French-speaking Caribbean, and I just wondered, how did that happen with you? I mean, it's really unusual. I've read Chamozo's Texaco because I have friends who recommended it to me. But I've never met an Australian who, came to it that way. So I'm interested in that.
I think because I was looking, and soon as and I saw the review of Texaco, and I didn't know Patrick Chemise. I had no idea who he was, and when I saw that review and read that review, and I said I had to read that book, and when I read that book. Texaco. I tried to put it in everybody's hands, and I said, "You must read this book. Not my copy, because I'm not going to give you my copy. Get your own copy." But but I wanted everybody to read that book. I just thought it was, so good and so important, and nothing. We've seen nothing like it, not in this country, but. It's just an act of the gods that I saw the review and I read it.
Wow.
Mm. And
what about the English speaking Caribbean's literature?
Not a lot, but only Marlon James, because everybody knows Marlon James, and he's is it Eight Killings, the brief history of Seven Killings, yeah. Seven Killings, yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah. Yeah. But it could be a lot more. But it seems like it a lot more. But but that's just an incredible book. He's there's no one like him either. And when I read that book and how he did that, and that storytelling style, of his, and which I'm really interested in storytelling, and how we treat our own stories and how we build on our stories and how we make storytelling leaders. That's really important to me here. And I just wondered how he did that too. And I thought, God, did he have a lot of researchers helping him to get all this information? Or he's just brilliant. And so I'm looking forward to his new book, but I just like how he did that, how he handled that, that book, and through all those different narrative voices, and incredible. You got some really great writers and great thinkers, that's for sure.
I wanted to ask you though, when you read Chamozo and Texaco, so the world of the magnificent, in terms of his the way he manipulates Creole, the French Creole language, how did that resonate with you? Because I know that also in your own work, are you using language of your people?
Mm-hmm.
And what examples were you able to take from Chamozo? Mm-hmm. To find his use of I heard you talk about Marlon James, but what is Chamozo doing for you in terms of how he was manipulating language, especially in Sony Boy the Magnificent? Because it's all about that disconnect between French and Creole.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that one group speaks and the fact that they don't get translated. And so therefore the stories are never apparent. And so I wondered, how did that work for you in your own work?
Well, it certainly gave me, you know, the freedom to, you know, it gives me strength to read a book like that, and strength to know you can do whatever you want in literature, and whatever, you know, and that's fine, and that's all I could probably say is that. It gives you strength and to know and that no one's going to put you in some, you know, some little corner and say, oh no, you've got to write like this or you've got to write like that. But he's done that and he got away with it. And it's just like all good art in the world is that in the end, you know, you go and do what you want to do and... good luck to you if you can get away with it.
I was wondering how you negotiated your way through, or how did you cope, as another way of using it, expressing it, cope with the Jamaican Creole sections in Marlon James's novel. I'm curious, I as a Jamaican found it difficult to read those sections, so I'm wondering about someone who has no knowledge of Jamaican
patois,
how that would work.
I don't know. I didn't really find any difficulty with his work. But you know, I just take things on. I take a lot of things on board as well, and you know, and there's maybe things that you know I don't really understand. I don't understand. You know, Creole in the Caribbean, I don't, and but what I read is, you know, it's probably been edited to so you could understand it a lot better. If you know you talk to some people on the street, I probably wouldn't understand, and be quite a lot different, and. But I just take, you know, what I read, and I try to understand, and maybe I assume too much too, and assume, are we saying this? Are we saying that? And leave it at that. But you know, I just try to, you know, embrace it. That's all.
Thank you.
Yep.
Well, it's been a terrific conversation, Alexis. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for coming up from Melbourne.
Thank you.